BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
I like talking to smart people and asking them questions. I don't know about you, but like, if I get in an elevator like with Bill Gates or Mark Cuban or Greg Popovich for that matter and ask him a bunch of questions, I would do it. We're going to take an elevator ride with Marshall Cho. For people who don't know Marshall, it's a guy who attended the University of Oregon, got a master's in mathematics from Columbia University. Born in Seoul, moved to Springfield when he was 10 years old. Not on loan, his parents brought him there. But he loves basketball. He loves teaching as well. Began his career through the Teach for America program, teaching math in the South Bronx in Harlem. He's the boys basketball coach at Future Leaders Institute. He took them to the New York City Charter School Championship. Then he went to Mozambique, where he worked as a coach and instructor with the National Basketball Federation there and became the varsity boys basketball coach there, launching that program. NBA's Basketball Without Borders, DeMatha Catholic High School in Maryland, coached there. Victor Oladipo, Quinn Cook, Jeremy Grant, among the players that he sent to the NBA. He was the director of basketball operations at the University of Portland, and then the varsity boys basketball coach at Lake Oswego High School, where he had success, League Coach of the Year, Nike Hoop Summit, Team USA, men's junior national team. You know some stuff. So let's get him on the show. Marshall Cho joining us. Does that sound like as you hear me kind of recount it, you're probably nodding your head going, oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Well, that was hard. That was quite a journey, Marshall.
Yeah, I'm exhausted just listening to congratulations. You did a heck of a job. Or thank you for that kind intro. But I did live that life. And sometimes I look back and, you know, I'm just filled with gratitude and also in wonderment and how it all played out the way it did. But I'm super grateful for the journey and looking forward to what's ahead next.
Give me an idea, you know, being a kid who comes from Seoul, you come from Korea, you're in Springfield, Oregon, and you have this love of basketball. How did, you know, you're 10 years old, that is not an easy age to make that kind of move.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's funny is about that is I didn't fall in love with basketball for probably another year after I had immigrated to the States. And I think, you know, when I look back on that journey in the late 80s, access to sports for us meant, at least for me, it meant that I was, you know, I had the good fortune of living right across the street from my park, right? That had tennis court, that had a baseball field, that had basketball courts. And there was a community that would come out and organically, you know, as a child, I would learn how to play. And again, I grew up playing baseball and soccer in Korea. Those are the two main sports. Soccer was where I learned that, you know, I was pretty good at it having grown up playing in it. So when I immigrated, didn't speak the language, just being able to blend in with the kids. But I mean, even beyond that, like stand out, you know, that attracted my classmates to me, right? So I understood at a young age that if you're good at sports, you know, there are things, you know, certain things in life that can play out well for you. At the same time, I love baseball, but, you know, my parents, you know, were working their hard, you know, immigrant transition from South Korea, didn't have the money or the means to give me access to baseball. So in an ironic way, because I didn't have access to one sport, you know, I had to seek out another sport where there wasn't a barrier to entry. I just needed a basketball and a hoop, and off I went.
You are a teacher, and I mean that with all respect. Like teachers within sports, some of the best coaches are great teachers. Where did you get that love of teaching others or maybe develop a passion for teaching others?
you know, I think you, a lot of that, you, it's learned behavior. You know, I, ironically, my mother, you know, had a real desire to be an art teacher when she was growing up in South Korea. They would have it, you know, that that's not the path that she was, you know, able to take. And she took a job at a bank where she met my dad. And, you know, fortunately for that, you know, coincidence, I'm here today, you know, raising my own kids in Lake Oswego. But I think I learned it really at home first, you know, my mom being the ultimate teacher for us children. But beyond that, you know, when I moved to the States, I was just really lucky. You know, I had a lot of teachers who poured into me, who took an interest in somebody who was an outsider, who didn't speak the language. And, you know, it was really truly a village, you know, experience growing up in Springfield, where the entire school rallied around, you know, the one or two ESL teachers that they would have, or ESL students that they would have moving in. So it started there. You know, again, I'm a little sheepish about this conversation being about me, because I think when I reached out to you, it was really, and we'll get to it, I'm sure, but, you know, yeah, it was about all these years later, seeing something familiar with what I grew up in, with so many volunteer coaches that I had, right? You know, the reason I called you is because there's a Little League baseball team here in our little pocket in Lake Ridge that is playing in the Babe Ruth World Series in Eagle Pass, Texas. And four of the coaches that are there have been volunteering basically since, you know, these are kids where my own son's teammates were going to be freshmen at Lake Ridge next year. And for the past 9 years, they've been volunteering countless hours as the youth soccer coach, baseball coach, basketball coach. So, you know, I had that growing up in Springfield. Like, you know, it's the same thing. It wasn't club sports. It wasn't even high school athletics yet. But it was the local dads who volunteered their time, passed on those values, and, you know, a big part of the reason why I'm the coach I am today.
Marshall Cho is with us, basketball coach. You're talking about baseball, but really, you know, we're talking coaching, and I'm going to get to how our listeners might be able to help this baseball team out. But, you know, give me an idea, because I think in today's, let's just say, college world, we are seeing coaches who entered the profession knowing there's a lot of money out there if they can get to the top levels. I don't think coaches got into it for money years ago. And I think in some weird way, it may have changed the type of people who are getting into the profession. But you're talking about the grassroots, you know, community volunteer coach who's not in this, you know, has, you know, who's working another job, who has, you know, is selling real estate or owns a small business and then is coaching a baseball team or coaching a basketball team on the side. Those people are community heroes.
Yeah, we don't talk about them enough. And, you know, on one hand, they're truly heroes. They're the backbone of our, you know, each of the little pockets of community we have. And the more of them that we have, you know, I think you see that reflected, you know, once you do see some of these high school, you know, programs performing in whatever their sport may be. But, you know, I think the other piece of it too, you do realize that, at least in our community too, in Lake Oswego, I think what's been really neat to see is that, you know, there's a lot of the parents show gratitude for these youth coaches, right? And the kids are, again, at that age, I think many of us get into coaching because we know that we're having an impact, a lifelong impact that's going to, you know, benefit these kids off the court. I think, and then you take that all the way up to college. You know, I've spoken to a lot of my, you know, former colleagues or coaches who moved on to that level, and I think they struggle with that now, given the landscape where, you know, I think even a lot of college coaches got into it because they want to impact lives. They want to enter into a transformational relationship, not a transactional one. But that's, you know, rapidly changing, as you've been covering for all of us with all the NIL and all the conference alignment, realignment. But, you know, I think as we anoint these heroes or celebrate them and thank them, also, you know, I think we want to get to that place again, you know, where coaches get something out of it too, because it's not in the financial gains that we all do this for. And that's talking about youth coaches all the way up to high school coaches, you know, across the state, you know, that work for the pennies to the dollar.
four Portland area teams heading to the World Series, including the 12-year-olds from West Lynn, the 16U team from Portland, the 18-under club from Kelso, and the 14U club from Lake Ridge that Marshall's talking about. Give me an idea of what it's like to be a parent watching your kid play on a team.
Yeah, you know, it's what. So what's really neat about this particular class, so my son actually was on, you know, what you may call the B team. So, you know, he's back home here with me dealing with this heat in a different way in Lake Oswego, Oregon. But the A team for our area, you know, they're not a club-based team. This is all the local kids who grew up here. I think that's what's also just neat about it. You know, they're truly representing this community and kids that they grew up with. And so, you know, what I'd love to do is these are kids that are my son's classmates, right? So what can those of us who are not on this journey, you know, do our part to help with that? And, you know, for me, it was just coming up with an idea to, you know, I have some camps, you know, I've been running locally and they've been doing well, but, you know, I always have a little bit of space to give. And, you know, I wanted to support them by having 100% of the proceeds of the camp go to these kids. And, you know, you're talking about those four teams, and I wonder about how all the other three teams are managing the costs. And, you know, maybe people outside of our community may not be thinking, hey, like, you know, players from Lake Oswego don't need that kind of financial help. But what I'm learning even through this experience, being on the ride from the outside and watching them and celebrating them, is, you know, they just went to Calgary, played a huge tournament. Now they're going to Texas of all places, and you don't really buy tickets or hotels or, you know, make all these arrangements until you're qualified. So the cost of these, you know, once in a lifetime opportunities can be really large. So it's been really neat to see how the, you know, community rallies, you know, rallied around this group, and I'm just trying to play my small part and see if I can help them cut the cost down a little bit.
For people who are interested, PacerYouthBaseball.org. is the website, and Marshall chose basketball camp August 5th through the 8th. Came at a donation of $200, offering an opportunity for kids that wanted to participate to give back. And, you know, for people who want to just make a donation, you can go to that website, PacerYouthBaseball.org, and you can give $10, give $100, give what you can. But Marshall, give me an idea, like, how coaching has changed, how kids have changed, how parents have changed in your time, maybe more recently coaching.
I think we're, again, it's you blink and now it's 2024. You know, we lived through the COVID times, and you know, that's 2020. I think back 4 years ago, that's a full graduating class. You know, I had the great honor of speaking at a commencement speech at Wichita State University this past spring. And as I was preparing for it, the folks at the university, the administration, reminded me that a lot of these kids didn't get to have their high school graduation. And a lot of the college, you know, graduates this past year, this was the first graduation ceremony that they got to go through in 8 years. I think at the end of the day, you know, as I'm talking about, you know, we sometimes look at youth basketball or any kind of youth scene, and we think the sky is falling, and we lament all that's going bad. And I think that's why I like an opportunity like this to talk to you, to celebrate that as I'm looking back in my late 80s and knowing, you know, thinking back to all the impactful dad coaches that I had, I got to kind of see that with this group that's coming up, Joe Bayless, Chris Affley, you know, and Steve Meyer and others. I see like a throwback to it. And I think that's where you get to celebrate that a little bit. You know, Brian Holmes, another coach who I grew up with in the Shelton area, like we talked about it a lot, where they wanted to kind of give that kind of same experience that I, you know, those of us in our mid to late 40s had. So as I'm telling you about this graduation, where, you know, college graduation, where this window of, you know, kids didn't get to have that, I think we're a more resilient group, if you look at it, more resilient than we may recognize. And I think focusing on those things, you know, will help us not sit back here and go, the times have changed, you know, and really, like, get into a mode of complaining versus trying to think of solutions and celebrating the things that are going well.
Give me an idea, because, you know, as I look at the Pacer Youth Baseball donation page, you've got a camp this week, and then you have a second camp on the 12th through the 15th. The cost
Correct.
Is $200. 100% of the proceeds go to help the travel expenses for this Babe Ruth World Series team. But, you know, this is a great opportunity for somebody who's got a kid who wants to work on their skills, wants to be taught, wants to, you know, be challenged a little bit. And give us an idea of what happens at, you know, Marshall Cho's basketball camp on August 12th.
You know, it's making sure that they're having fun, that, you know, that they actually own, you know, they have a sense of ownership for the camp, I think is the biggest trick of it all. You know, most camps, you know, they might come in and, you know, you're focusing mostly on games, but I like to try to sandwich some of that fundamentals and all that, you know, all the important footwork or, you know, your shooting technique or your passing, you know, acumen. We want to give that to them while, you know, sandwiching it with a lot of kids breaking sweat and having games. So at the end of the day, you know, you want them coming back and, you know, going home and basically asking, you know, when they can come back to camp the next day or if they can come back earlier. One of the things that I think I've done a good job of over the years is, you know, it's something I've taken from the USA Basketball Junior National Team program. And it's also, you know, from my time and influence from Morgan Wooten at the Mapa Catholic, the powerhouse basketball program you were describing it, you know, earlier in the introduction. I think the great coaches, like you said, you know, we want to try to impart something, you know, that touched their hearts and minds. You want to give them some quotes that, you know, they can really think about. You know, the quote that I gave the kids today and challenged them to talk about it at home at the dinner table is, you know, true growth only happens when you leave your comfort zone. You know, inch by inch, life is inch, yard by yard, life is hard. That's the Dr. Seuss quote that Morgan Wooten used to quote. And just reminding everybody that, you know, it's really, again, you want a camp or you want a practice of a high school practice. You want the post-game locker room talk in the locker room at a high school varsity game. You want those to, that whatever you're giving your players, you want that the conversation to continue to take place and live on organically in their own communities, in their own, you know, households. So that's been the best part of being a camp coach over the years for me, when a parent will come back the next day and say, hey, on the car ride home, you know, you think about the car ride home for a lot of these youth players. And we, as coaches, we try to remind parents to not talk about the game that just happened, right? And then think about a camp, a summer camp experience where you're getting in the car, you're not talking about the stats, how many points you scored or why you lost the game, who took more shots than the other guy on the team. You're not thinking about any of that, but you're thinking about, you know, mind candies like the ones that I just mentioned, and a father or a mother asking their child, like, what does it look like for you to leave a comfort zone? And what does growth look like? So when parents come back the next day from a camp and tell me that they had a meaningful car ride conversation or a meaningful conversation at the dinner table, you know, those are the priceless wins that that you can't list on my you know, long resume or any of us, you know, who got into this profession for the right reasons.
Well, I just think it's amazing that, you know, a parent who's listening to the show could sign their kid up and they're getting in the kind of instruction that, you know, is being given at the Hoop Summit, or the kind of instruction that you would see at high level high school and college programs. It's $200. It's the 12th through the 15th. Do you have ages, Marshall? Like, you know, what's too young? What's too old?
Yeah, you know, I try to make, it's funny. We just talked about the comfort zone quote. You know, I like to, sometimes I shake my head and wonder, you know, why I make it a little bit challenging for myself. But the camp that we have going on at Riverside High School next week will be grades first through eighth grade. And so the challenge sometimes, you put it out like that. You know, you get the seventh or eighth graders who might be too cool for school and not want to be in the same space as a first grader. But, you know, we staff it with plenty of coaches and we make sure to meet the players where they're at so that they're challenged appropriately. So it's a beautiful space, a brand new high school 3A program in the Westland Wilsonville District. It's a program led by Chuck Matthews, a longtime veteran coach of Madison High School. They're building something special there. And so it's just a privilege for me to be in that building for a few hours next week, and hopefully, you know, raise some money that'll go to a good cause and celebrate the kids from our neighborhood.
So you're talking grades 1 through 8 next week. The cost is $200. Oddly, you can go to PacerYouthBaseball.org, and you can see that.
Backslash donations.
But I'm also tweeting out a link, direct link.
Beautiful.
For the camp. Yeah. So I'm about to tweet this out, and it is a link that will take you right to the checkout of that camp. And, you know, you had one this week. How did it go this week? How did this week's camp go? It ended today, I guess.
Yeah, it ended today. It was a blast. I mean, you talk about, you know, I'm the luckiest coach in the world. I've had a charmed life. And when it comes to coaching some exceptional young men at Lake Oswego High School and all the other kids throughout, but I love, you know, time spent in the gym teaching a first grader how to shoot for the first time, because it takes me back to when somebody did that for me. So it's a way of giving back. But, you know, it's one thing to get to have the privilege to coach Cooper Flagg and come on Mala Watch and AJ DeBontos of the world. But, you know, there's something about giving back to the kids right in our backyard and waiting to see if any one of them will get a chance to turn into a Peyton Pritchard or a Jackson Shellstad or a Josh Engel. So it's a privilege I don't take lightly. And we had a blast today. So hopefully another great week of basketball ahead for the kids who will come next week.
I was talking to Kyle Smith, the Stanford coach, about Jackson Shellstad, and I said, you know, there's so much change. The roster at Oregon's going to have all this turnover. He kind of just paused, and then he said, Jackson Shellstad's going to have no problem with anybody around him. He will not be affected by anybody around him. You got a chance to coach against that kid, and now you're watched him at Oregon. What do you make of Jackson's game?
You know, I watched him obviously a little bit in Oregon, but even this past week, Nike Skills Academy took place on Nike World Headquarters campus. Jackson was one of the college players invited, so I literally got to see him the last few days. Looks like he's put on some muscle, and again, you know, it's one thing to be a lead guard in a brand new conference. It's just weird for me to say, having grown up at Oregon and attended Oregon. But it's another thing, you know, whether I got to see him at the Hoop Summit, you know, competing for the USA team. And now, you know, just even this past week, he was with some of the best college players in the country and holding his own and doing just fine. So I'm looking forward to rooting him on. And, you know, hopefully we can get some W's for my alma mater coming here in the Big Ten Conference.
Maybe you can help me with a little debate in my own household, Marshall. Forget the sport, because I think sometimes coaching is just coaching and parenting is just parenting, but it happens to be soccer. And you've got coaches that are trying to coach and teach the kids fundamentals and teach the kids the game. You have parents who are well-intentioned, who are yelling from the sideline, giving their instruction. And you have kids who are like 8 years old out onto the field who are a little confused because mom and dad are telling them to do one thing and the coach is telling them to do another thing. How do you navigate that as a coach? And what advice do you give to parents who are kind of out on the side there wanting to give instruction, wanting to be helpful, but maybe clouding or muddying the waters a little?
You know, I'm still going through it myself. So first of all, I think what I would tell the parents, again, I think, like earlier, we talked about, you know, what's going on with youth sports. And I think depending on the lens that you're putting on for each day, we can all become more cynics than problem solvers. So, you know, when I hear a question like that, you know, the temptation is to kind of turn this into an adversarial situation.
Right.
Between players, parents, and coaches, right? And I think I have more empathy now that I'm a parent. My daughter does not play any basketball, which is probably a good thing for our family. She's chosen also to use soccer as an outlet for herself. And, you know, anytime I sit myself and just, it's human nature to question, I think. You know, you take a step back and you recognize that these folks are doing it for pennies on the dollar. And, you know, what you can do on the flip side of just, you know, when they go to practice or when they come back from games is, you know, to be a supportive, you know, person for your own backyard. You know, if you know, for me, it's been just trying to steal a little bit of time where, you know, my daughter will go and kick around with me when it's on her terms, you know. If it's my son, for me, with basketball in particular, I love it when I see my son having to figure it out on his own. I now support him, I say on his own, but really, we want problem solvers at the end of the day. I think that's true in sports. If you think about whether it's, you know, for me coaching at the Hoop Summit game, I needed at the end of the shot clock, Nolan Trahor, a point guard from France, to make the decision. I'm not taking the shot. I'm not making the passes, right? But it's the same thing. If at the end of the day, you want that eighth grade kid to have a chance to make the shot or take the shot, have the courage to take it. And I think if we stay in our lanes as the cheerleaders to pick up our kids, you know, at the end of it all, I think it'll do all of us, you know, save us a lot of grief on the journey. And it'll be better for the kids in the long term.
Marshall Cho, I have tweeted out the link to his basketball camp for next week. If you got a kid, grade 1 through 8, give it a look. $200. The proceeds, 100% of the proceeds, go to help an area baseball team trying to pay their way to the Babe Ruth World Series. Marshall Cho, thank you for joining us. I appreciate you, my friend.
John, thank you for your time. Appreciate you.
You bet. There he goes, Marshall Cho. You can tell he's not here to get into a debate. He's not here to be fuel on the fire. I want to talk more about youth sports, and I want your input as well. What do you love about youth sports? What troubles you about youth sports? We're going to talk about it next. Leave it here. You got the BFT statewide.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Best part of youth sports, we hit on it with Jake Dickard on yesterday's show. The Washington State coach talked about the competition and his kid, and, you know, we were kind of sharing a moment where I was speaking about, you know, watching my kid's soccer team, and he was watching his kid's 10U baseball team, and my brother even had this experience, like, you know, during the summer he was talking about, he said, you know, he actually likes to see his kids fail, in a way, in youth sports. I know it sounds weird, but not saying you root for your kid to fail, I'm just saying that you realize as a parent that it's okay if your kid fails in youth sports, because as much as you want to see him have success, maybe the next best thing or an even better thing is to see them battle against their limitations and struggle a little bit and, you know, show some perseverance and have some mettle and then break through in another way or another event, or, you know, not just that they go out there and everything comes easy to them. You know, there's something to be said for building confidence in your kid, but I would tell you this, sociologists and psychologists, child psychologists would tell you that confidence is born not from just having success, 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 but is born from having some failure in there that you're able to work through and overcome, and not with the help of a parent gaming the system for you, as much as we all love to do that. I think one of the best things about youth sports is seeing all the healthy kids that are out there playing it. Look into any huddle on any playground or any field that you pass by. If your kid plays a sport, take a look when they go in and they all put their hands in the middle. Steven, you know this, like, you, they go in, they go, okay, you know, team on three or whatever it is they say on three these days. Look at those kids. They're all healthy kids. They're all outside. They're off their iPads. They're not gaming. They are breaking a sweat. They're raising their pulse. They're getting their cardiovascular health. They're creating habits that will last the rest of their lives, for crying out loud. And so the health of those kids is a positive benefit to playing youth sports. What do you see as the other benefits of youth sports?
I think it's friendships. You learn how to deal with a lot of different people. When you're playing sports, you deal with the people that are ultra competitive and they're out there talking trash. And then you deal with other people that are, a little standoffish and will stand off to the side, but then they play really hard. And you kind of have to deal with all different type of people, as well as maybe you play your friend on the other team. And I think that is important as well to kind of, put out the differences between friendship and competition. Like, it's okay to be competitive against your friends. And even at that age, they got to figure that out as well. I love this. I love just watching kids when they are interacting, even after the games or before the games, and they're watching another team and they get ready to play. And you can just see the smiles on their faces. Like, they're just having fun hanging out with one another. Like, I think sports just provide so much outside of the actual sport. It makes you deal with life. And so it's just, it's competitiveness. It's just dealing with other people and forcing you to have to work as a team, because some people aren't great as a team player. They're more of an individual.
What do you mean dealing with other people? Get into that a little bit.
Well,
I'm interested.
There's just some people that you don't necessarily get along with, or you're not friends with. Like, I've had numerous people on my teams that I don't like as people. I just think they're annoying, or I don't like their personality, or I don't like what they stand for. But when they're on your team, you still have to deal with them. And it's okay to deal with them in a certain way, because they're your teammate and you have to work with them, but you don't have to be friends with them. And I think that's a big differentiator. I always tell my son that, like, you don't have to like the people on your team, but you have to work with the people on your team. And that's important just going forward in life. Like, your team is not going to be your friends all the time. And that's hard to deal with. It's hard to work with.
So essentially you're saying that there's an element to this of having to work with difficult people as a kid is going to help you work with difficult people as an adult.
I think so, yeah. And I think it also goes to the fact of, like you're saying, it's putting you in an awkward situation where you're going to fail, and you're going to, you could blame other people. Like, you could, it's easy to say, I don't like that person. It was their fault. But, sometimes you got to take some responsibility for yourself too.
I played a lot of youth sports, and I've talked about playing youth sports and playing for a lot of different coaches. And I think I got a lot out of all that, and having teammates and, developing this sense of, there's something bigger than, there's an element to, sports that there's something, the team being greater than the individual. Right. But, one of the most valuable seasons I ever had was a terrible season. And my dad, who had played professional baseball, people in my community knew that my dad was a shortstop who played AAA baseball. And so when I was like 9 years old, what happened? The boys' major division, which is normally 10, 11, and 12 year olds, the first place team in that boys' majors division drafted me. Kind of unfair. I should find that coach and be like, dude, why did you, and so I'm 9 and I'm playing against 11 and 12 year olds. And I got to be honest with you, Steven, I couldn't see the ball. Like, they were throwing so hard. It might have been, it looked like it was 200 miles an hour to a 9 year old kid. And I struggled that season, and I batted 083. As a 9 year old, I should have been playing minors with, the 9 and the 10 year olds, not the 11 and 12 year olds, but I batted 083. It was terrible. I struck out all the time. It was awful. No matter how much batting practice I took, I was just physically overmatched by the kids that were out there. And the thing that happened for me though is like, I just remember suffering and suffering, and I can't even remember what my parents' reaction to that was. But I can remember having tears in my eyes in the dugout, okay? And like, it wasn't a positive association. But I worked so hard that I came back the next year and the year after, And I can remember having great success hitting, you know, batting over 300 as a little leaguer. Who cares? But for me, it felt like I was Ted Williams all of a sudden. But what was born from that was any time in my life after that that I had any kind of struggle, I had that experience to draw upon where I was like, this is nothing. I've struck out 11 times in a row in a little league season because I was 9, for crying out loud. I probably should have been batting off a tee. But I think back to it and I'm like, you know, in a weird way, all that failure was good for me. And, you know, navigating that system. Now, it was patently unfair for some little league coach to go, okay, his dad played professional baseball, therefore he's going to be good, and drafting me and sticking me in that situation. But I can remember my dad telling my dad, I was like, I don't want to play on this team. I went to one practice and I was like, these guys are grownups. Like, what am I doing here? And I played right field and I batted 083. And, you know, I went on to play college baseball, but I never forgot that experience. Like, I can't remember any other season and any other stretch of play in my little league career, but I can remember striking out 11 times in a row. And you know what else? I can remember the next year in my very first at bat hitting a home run. And I had worked so hard. And I did that, right? As a 9, 10, 11-year-old kid. It stayed with me for life. And I think, you know, for a lot of us, and I'm as guilty as anybody. I started the segment earlier this week talking about my kid's soccer game. For a lot of us, we want success for our kids. We want our kids to get the glory. We want them to feel good. And I think we get a little bit swept up into the idea of, like, success at 8, 9, 10 years old means that's going to build confidence in them and that's going to be the best thing that can happen for them at this age. We really want to protect them. But I think one of the great beauties of youth sports is, like, all the failure and the safe failure that happens in youth sports. Sister Krista, who runs the CYO organization in the area, she knows what I'm talking about. I told her one place, I said, this CYO thing is the best thing ever. It's a safe place for kids to fail. You can just face plant and, you know, you got a bunch of adults there going, hey, this is great. You know, you're going to be great. It's going to be fine. But you, as a parent, we really should resist the idea of swooping in to kind of save them. And I realized, like, you know, on Monday when I was kind of doing that rant about youth sports and, you know, how, you know, it's good, failure is good. And all, you know, I was talking to myself because I think you got to be okay watching your kid develop life skills and not just get a trophy. Or, you know, these days, the parents who are giving out, like, you know, individual trophies and batting titles and championship belts and stuff like that. You know, let's get a hold of ourselves. Leave it here. We got Punch It Audio coming up, 5 at 5, top of the hour. So much more ahead.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over 1 million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I think that's usually what teams that aren't getting recruits are saying. It's never, hey, we got outworked, we got out-recruited, we got out-coached in a game. It's they bought themselves their class. They did something nefarious, and that's why we finished second. And, I mean, you go back to when Chip Kelly landed Eric Armstead and DeAnthony Thomas before NIL even existed. And, you know, Oregon, it's not like Oregon just came out of the blue and started recruiting well in the last 2.5 years. They've been recruiting well for the last 15 to 20 plus years. I mean, you can go back to Haladi Nada to say it. So I think that's just, you know, kind of runner-up mentality, if you will.
That is Brandon Huffman on yesterday's program talking about the criticism that Oregon is getting for having a strong NIL collective and recruiting well. If you want to listen to that whole interview, grab a podcast of the Bald Faced Truth Radio Show on Apple Podcasts. Now, we're going to play some Punch It.
We interrupt this broadcast with- another special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Well, Athlon Sports had a highly critical piece on Coach Prime in the Colorado program, outlining, violence and tomfoolery that is going on inside the program. Steve Corder, Athlon Sports, talking about why the players want to stay anonymous. A lot of anonymous quotes in that piece. Punch it.
You know, I don't know if there's a reason why they should trust it. I just know I've talked to these kids, these young men. They're scared. They're worried about repercussions, whether it be players that are no longer there or players that are there. So, you know, I'm just doing what I think is what's right, what needs to be done. If this was going on anywhere, I would think that anybody would want to know about it, whether it's the university, whether it's the state, whether it's the players' families, whatever that may be.
Drip, drip, drip. I've said that before. It's like a leaky faucet. We're seeing players, reports, criticisms of the Colorado program. Drip, drip, drip. It's just steady. It's not going to stop. I wonder where it will end. And if Colorado's not good on the field this season, look out. Keep an eye on Coach Prime and Colorado. Patriots offering Brandon Ayuk $32 million a year. Mike Garofalo says that was the number, that was the offer. Punch it.
$32 million a year is what the Patriots were willing to do. Now, let's put that number in context. Justin Jefferson's up at 35. CeeDee Lamb's going to be up around there. Jamar Chase, whether he does it this year or next year, he's going to be up around there. That's the upper echelon of wide receivers. There's a big spread between 35 and 28, which is where Amon-Ra St. Brown and Jaylen Waddle, Devontae Smith, very well defined at $28 million a year for these guys. Ayuk in his mind feels like he's a number one. When I get evaluations around the league, they say, well, he's a 1B, like he's on the bottom of that one tier. We'd consider him a one. So in his mind, he's saying, well, I at least got to be at the 28 number that these other guys were at. And the Niners weren't there. The Patriots were willing to split those two tiers. That was by, I'm telling you right now, no matter where he signs, no matter where he gets traded, no matter where the next deal comes from, whether it's the Niners or anybody else, I'll still leave them involved. It's not going to be that number. So he's already, I can tell you, he has already turned down more money to go wherever else he is going to be.
Brandon Ayuk, is it the Steelers? Is it somewhere else? Well, Steelers apparently not willing to give up players. 49ers want players. Other teams may be getting involved, but even a report earlier this morning in the New York Post said that the 49ers are looking for two first-round picks in exchange for Brandon Ayuk. If Ayuk is valuing himself as a upper echelon receiver, the 49ers certainly doing that by asking for two firsts. What happens to Ayuk? How does this end? Steven? Is it in with him in another uniform and everybody happy, or who has to make the ultimate concession? Is it Ayuk? Is it the 49ers? Is it some other team?
I think the 49ers are going to have to make the decision here. I don't know that they're going to get all that they want, and two first-round picks seems like a lot for Ayuk. It seems like it's going to be, can the 49ers stomach not getting anything for him and hoping that he comes back and plays for the team for the 1 year and then they lose him next season? I think that's what they're going to have to kind of consider. Or they're just going to have to trade him for what they can get. And I think they'll be able to get a good package. But it seems like, John, they're just trying to maneuver this and strategize this so they play in where they have the leverage and these other teams have to give a little bit more when they know they don't have the leverage. Brandon Ayuk does. He has the ability to negotiate with teams. He got $32 million offered by the Patriots. He said no, he doesn't want to go there. So he wants to go to one of two teams. The 49ers don't really have much leverage. I think they're trying to play this game, but they're going to be the ultimate ones that have to sacrifice a little bit.
Josh Pate talking about the University of Oregon. He has two questions about the Ducks. Punch it.
Here's what I want to know about Oregon. Is that pass defense going to step up? Because it hurt them against Washington last year twice. They need transfers to pan out in that secondary. If they do that, they'll be okay. If they don't, then you got some track meets. And maybe not maybe not up and down the list of Big Ten teams they play, but eventually you're going to run into a team that can throw the ball on you. And if it's the playoffs, it's the playoff. If it's week six, it's week six. So that's the first thing. The second thing is on the other side of the ball, Dylan Gabriel. So they get him at quarterback. It's a big-time transfer. Gabriel's going to be right up there with some of the best odds to win the Heisman. Are they going to get top 10 quarterback play from him or top three? Because that could be the difference in winning a title versus having another really good year, but the big one escaping you.
I just sometimes feel like these preseason talks are about filling time. The question for Oregon on the defensive side of the ball is not about the pass defense. Pay attention. It's about the run defense. We're talking about Oregon going to the Big Ten Conference, where Ohio State plays. Two of the country's top running backs, an experienced offensive line, and oh, by the way, they just added Chip Kelly to the mix. Who is Chip Kelly as a coordinator? Chip Kelly's teams have ranked in the top 17 nationally in each of the last 4 years in rushing yards per game. UCLA was number one in the country in 2021 in rushing yards per attempt. They averaged 6 yards per carry. Chip Kelly at Ohio State, that's the team to beat if you're Oregon. Chip Kelly's going to try to run the ball and then run the ball. And everybody who watched Oregon with Chip Kelly coaching it knows that Oregon wasn't throwing the ball all over the place. Receivers didn't want to play for Chip Kelly. They ran the ball. They've got a great running game at Ohio State. Oregon's got to stop it. The question on defense is, can Oregon play with one of the best run offenses in the country? How will they fare against that? That's the question. We'll hear about the challenges for Oregon State coming up. Plus, John Wilner and I interviewed Teresa Gold, the Pac-12 Conference Commissioner today. I'll tell you what I learned.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Super excited that we're on in Bend, Oregon now. The Bald-Faced Truth Radio Network extending to Central Oregon. Sun River in Bend, welcome to the family. The Ticket 92.5 FM now on. My mother-in-law listening in Southern Oregon on the Ace in Medford. Welcome them to the network as well. Let's not forget Eugene and Fox Sports Eugene, Steve and the team there at 10:50 a.m. Klamath Falls, 9:60 a.m. Shout out to Klamath Falls. Roseburg, KSKR, 1490. Fist bump to you in Roseburg. And those of you listening on 750 The Game, powerhouse signal out of Portland, all the way down to Salem, Woodburn, and beyond. Thank you for making this show part of your day. You may be streaming out of state. I haven't forgotten you, Southern Washington. I haven't forgotten you either. But I just want to welcome the newest affiliate to the BFT Radio family. Excited to be on in Bend. This hour, we'll play 5 at 5. I keep saying we play the 5 at 5 like it's a game. Is it a game to you, Stephen? Does it feel like a game?
No, not a game. Not a game. Not a game. Not the game. Practice. No. It's not
practice. We're talking about practice.
We're not talking about the game. I don't think it's a game.
Because I say play it.
Right.
It feels competitive to me though. Because there's part of it that feels like, you know, this is a thing. It's you and me, and we're jousting. It's not like we're against each other. But we are playing. Well, this is a game.
Like, I do feel like a competition when I'm putting together the stories. I'm like, is that good enough to get in the 5 at 5? Like there's a benchmark here.
Ooh, I'll be the judge of that. I'll tell you, does it belong in the 5 at 5? In addition to my opinion on it. All right, let's play 5 at 5.
The 5 at 5. Number one.
What do you got? Let's see what he leads with.
I'm nervous now.
This is
a lot of pressure. Noah Lyles was going for history today as he was trying to be the first man since Michael Johnson to win, or Carl Lewis, sorry, to win the... To win the 100 and 200 meter dash at the Olympics. He did not do it. He finished third. But then there were reports afterwards that he had gotten COVID 2 days before. This was Noah Lyles talking to Lewis Johnson after the race, just kind of solidifying everything that people were talking about.
I reported that you tested positive for COVID 2 days ago. What was your reaction to that diagnosis?
Yeah, I woke up early, about 5 a.m. on Tuesday morning, and I just was feeling really horrible. And I knew it was more than just being sore from the 100, you know. Woke up the doctors and we tested, and unfortunately it came up that I was positive for COVID. You know, my first thought was not to panic. You know, thinking, you know, I've been in worse situations. You know, I've run with, you know, worse conditions, I felt. And we just took it day by day, trying to hydrate as much, quarantined off. And I definitely say that it's taken its toll for sure, but I've never been more proud of myself for being able to come out here and getting a bronze medal, where last Olympics I was very disappointed, and this time I couldn't be more proud.
Did you ever consider not running the 200 final?
No, I didn't. I just said we were just going to try and quarantine as much as possible, stay away, not trying to, you know, pass it off, and just, to be honest, give it my all. If I wasn't to make it, then somebody would have definitely taken my spot, and that would have been my sign that I, you know, didn't deserve to be in the final.
First thing I thought of was, you know, pretty impressive that you could still have a bronze medal despite being sick.
And he has asthma as well.
Second thing I thought of was how ridiculous it was that the governor in the state of Oregon had kids running with masks on during the pandemic. And we now know, here's this guy running in the Olympics, and he's not even that worried about the people running around him. Not saying COVID isn't serious.
Do you think he should have ran the race?
I think if he felt like he was okay to run, then he's okay to run.
I asked Coach Vaughn what her opinion was on it. She said he definitely needed to run the race, and it definitely would affect him, like his breathing and stuff like that. So it is pretty impressive that he has asthma, had COVID, still got third in the race.
I would have been more impressed if he didn't tell anybody and it kind of leaked out. Like,
do you think it'd be a cover up where he really didn't have it? He just had a bad race.
No, because I think that could potentially make him look really bad. But I almost think like, if I would have had more respect for him if he didn't say anything, you know, and it just kind of leaked out somehow slowly instead of him doing an interview about it. Then I would have been like, damn, he didn't even make an excuse and he still got a bronze. That's a flex.
Number two.
It's a good story there you started with, by the way.
Thank you.
Credit where it's due.
Well, we're going to continue with the Olympics. There's a huge game of basketball today in the semifinals. Classic game between Team USA and Serbia, led by Nikola Jokic. USA down by 17 points in the second half. Made a comeback in the fourth quarter, outscoring Serbia 32-15 in that final quarter to get the 95-91 win. Steph Curry led the way, hit 9 three-pointers. He was on fire in the first half, really kept USA afloat when Serbia was on fire the entire half. LeBron ends up with a triple-double. Now they're going to take on the host nation, France, and Victor Wembanyama in the gold medal game as France pulled off an upset today, beating Germany 73-69. Look ahead line. We got USA favored between 15 and 16 and a half points, so big-time favorite to win the gold medal. But going up against the host nation, it should be a tough matchup.
Booker, James.
We're going to pick and roll.
Oh. Curry for the lead. Oh, kaboom!
We said we was going to get our Steph Curry moment.
That's how it sounded. Steph Curry 1 point shy of the Olympic single game scoring record for a U.S. player. Carmelo Anthony had 37 once upon a time. It's the most NBA thing ever for Team USA to kind of have a letdown game in the semifinal round. They'll be on point for the final. They will win gold. Wembanyama, not good enough to do it on his own. United States going to be 6-0 and walk off with the gold medals. Number three.
Some big news down in Corvallis made yesterday as gold medalist Jade Carey. She announced that she will be returning to Oregon State for her final year of eligibility for gymnastics. Of course, Carey is part of the Golden Girls squad led by Simone Biles. Got gold last week in Paris. Carey also earned bronze on vault to boost her career Olympic gold or medal total to 3. She has the bronze and some golds. Carrie talked about extensively about how she's thrived in the college environment down in Corvallis. Pointed out that she's her comfort in competing for the Beavers, which actually helped her, she said, compete on the Olympic stage. She made this announcement yesterday while visiting Corvallis. Had a nice little ceremony there for her and celebration for her. But Oregon State getting back a big key part of the Olympic team, back on the gymnastic team for next season.
First thing I thought of was NIL money. You know, is Oregon State buying itself a gymnastics team? You know, sorry. But my mind went to NIL. She must have a decent NIL deal, or maybe there's just not that much money out there for gymnasts outside of, maybe being an Olympic athlete. But Jade Carey, she kind of likes to fly under the radar. We've had her on the show. She's really understated and kind of chill for an Olympic athlete and fits at Oregon State. It'll be interesting because Oregon State Gymnastics, I had previously reported that the Big 12 was trying to decide should they allow Oregon State Gymnastics into their conference. Everybody thought they would be allowed into the conference. Everybody expected that the Beavers, along with schools like Utah, Arizona State, Denver, West Virginia participates in the Big 12 in gymnastics. They thought, you know, that Oregon State Gymnastics would, so to speak, dip a toe into the Big 12. It was voted down by the Big 12 athletic directors. They vetoed that move. Oregon State will be an independent in gymnastics. Number four.
Earlier in the show, we were talking about our fandom and how there are some crazy fans out there. Well, this year, the Tennessee Titans, they're breaking ground on a new stadium, but that stadium won't open until 2027. But what they're doing is they're accepting applications for their new dedicated fan section that they are calling the Mosh Pit. If you're part of the Mosh Pit, you get access to seats by the live stage during the football games, dedicated invitations to events, complimentary annual merchandise, and exclusive chance to buy specifically priced PSLs in a dedicated lower level. Now, the Mosh Pit will be located in the East End Zone, which is the surrounding an in-bowl stage and reserved for the most passionate and energetic of Tennessee Titans fans. And to get into the Mosh Pit, John, I think we need to do this. You have to submit a video and show you why you are the biggest fan of the Tennessee Titans. So I would love to see some of those videos of some of those fans of what they come up with. But would you ever join the Mosh Pit of your favorite team?
No, I'm not a Mosh Pit guy right now at this point in my life. There might have been a point in my life where I would have been in the Mosh Pit. But I am more inclined, you know, do they have club seating?
Do they have like a comfortable chair area? Yeah.
They have a recliner. That's an underrated thing. Like, everybody's into these living room suites. It's like these mini suites that, you know, college teams and pro teams have figured out, like, that they can sell. But how about just, like, one lazy boy on the mezzanine?
It's like the recliner row. Yeah. You get a row of recliners.
Yes. You're onto something there. Finally.
Number five.
I am hoping this happens as the SEC, they are reportedly moving toward a mandatory injury report for this upcoming football season. Now, it hasn't been officially approved yet, John, but multiple sources are saying that the details are close to being finalized, and they are expected to start at the start of the 2024 season. Remember last year, the Big Ten became the first Power 5 conference to institute that game day report of injury during the season, and it was a move designed to protect the integrity of the game with respect to gambling. Now, the league's weekly report had two categories for injured players, questionable or out, so the Big Ten will be doing it again. SEC may join them. Last year, LSU and Florida did release weekly injury reports, but they were the only two schools in the SEC to do that. Everyone else stood strong, did not want to do that, but I think this is the right move. And I think it's going to be a move that in college sports is going to have to be more widely known with all the sports gambling.
Why are they doing this? Gambling, yes, but why? What's in it? Is it the gambling partners that are saying, hey, we really want this to happen, and we really need this, you know, this integrity of the game? Or
yeah, because we saw in baseball, remember, the coach was it? The Iowa coach?
Yeah.
He was, you know, he's betting on the, he was having people bet on the games and he was giving them inside information. I feel like just the more information that's out there, the more that we can trust what's happening on the field and we don't have to say, oh, well, this game is rigged or these refs are in it or these coaches aren't trying, these players are throwing the game. I feel like it's the more information that we have out there, the less that people are going to do that. And now there's still going to be people that are always going to say the game is rigged and, you know, people are throwing the game. But I feel like it's just less and less as more information gets out there.
Well, yeah. And I think we kind of hit on this off the top of the show, how gambling and how Fantasy League has changed the way you consume games as a sports fan. Well, how about this? How about, you know, it used to be once upon a time that the NCAA said, we won't hold a championship event anywhere that allows legalized sports wagering. Then all of a sudden, it's like Viva Las Vegas, baby. And oh, by the way, here's an injury report for our gambling partners. Well, so much has changed, so much money involved.
Think about today, had we known Noah Lyles had COVID, he would not have been the favorite. I looked right before the race. He was minus 450 to win the race. So nobody knew that he had COVID or, you know, or they didn't think it would affect him this much. But I think if people knew he had COVID, there'd be other bets on other people. I feel like there's got to be that information out there. A lot of people probably lost some money betting on Noah Lyles because he was the big-time favorite to win that race.
Do you think there is an obligation that these teams should have or these athletes should have to disclose when they are injured? Or because Noah Lyles said he wanted to keep that a secret, and he didn't want his, you know, fellow competitors to know that he wasn't at 100%.
Yes, I think as a competitor, I don't want my opponents to know everything about me. So, yes, I understand from his point of view. But I do think we are in a world now where safety is the most important thing. Like, or that's what they're supposed to talk about is safety of all these things, like especially football. So I feel like injuries do need to be reported because of that. Just for the PR of looking at it. Like, looking like they care.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've had coaches at Oregon and Oregon State in the past who said it's not in my best interest to talk about injuries. I'm not going to disclose injuries. That's going to help the opposition. And now they're in a situation. Here's Chip Kelly coaching now at Ohio State. Ohio State has to put out an injury report every week, you know. And will they do it only for conference games forever, or will they get pressure from their partners to do it for non-conference games as well? And will that be part of the contract when teams sign on for non-conference games that, hey, because you're playing in our stadium and our conference requires an injury report, you have to do an injury report that week? Keep an eye on that.
Is there ever going to be a day when a sportsbook is sponsoring a college team?
Yes. Yes.
And they have a sportsbook maybe even at the stadium?
Yes. And they're going to say, responsible gaming. Yeah, athletes, be careful. You know, buyer be
college students,
beware.
Bring your fake ID, say you're 21.
College students are not supposed to be gambling there, Stephen, and yet we all know what's going to be happening. All right, we got to deal with our sports landscape coming up. You heard Josh Pate earlier in the show give his two things that he is concerned about as it pertains to the Oregon Ducks. I have two things that I think are better than his two things. Sometimes people just fill the air with noise. I'm not saying he's doing that, but it sounded like it to me. I'll give you my two things that Oregon and Oregon State, the two big questions I have for each of those programs coming up.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Here's what I want to know about Oregon. Is that pass defense going to step up? Because it hurt them against Washington last year twice. They need transfers to pan out in that secondary. If they do that, they'll be okay. If they don't, then you got some track meets. And maybe not up and down the list of Big Ten teams they play. But eventually, you're going to run into a team that can throw the ball on you. And if it's the playoffs, it's the playoff. If it's week six, it's week six. So that's the first thing. The second thing is on the other side of the ball, Dylan Gabriel. So they get him at quarterback. It's a big-time transfer. Gabriel's going to be right up there with some of the best odds to win the Heisman. Are they going to get top 10 quarterback play from him or top three? Because that could be the difference in winning a title versus having another really good year, but the big one escaping you.
I don't really see it that way with Dylan Gabriel. Top 10 or go, you know, I have confidence in Will Stein, the offensive coordinator, that he's going to put him into position. And I think the Oregon's wide receiver core is the best or deepest that it has been maybe ever at Oregon. Just so much talent, so much promise. There's youth in places, but I'm not worried about Dylan Gabriel. The two questions I have for Oregon are very different than the questions that Josh Pate has for Oregon. One, I'm not worried about Oregon's pass defense. I'm worried about Oregon's run defense, because Oregon's season, like it or not, will not be dictated on, you know, how many pass yards do they give up here or there? Was the pass defense improved or better? I think Oregon's got athletes. I think they're young in the secondary, but I think they are, that's a position where you can play young, as we talked to Jake Dickert about that yesterday. If you got really talented guys there, you can play young there. But the question for Oregon is, how good can their run defense be? Can they force teams to be one-dimensional? Can they keep Ohio State from running all over the field with Chip Kelly game planning in the run game? Chip Kelly is brilliant in calling run plays and designing a game plan and designing a offense around the run game. We watched it at Oregon. It was a thing of beauty. He's now at Ohio State trying to do that same darn thing. Can Oregon defend Chip Kelly's run attack? That is a huge thing. It's October 12th. If Oregon doesn't give Ohio State problems with its run defense, Oregon will have a very long day.
But do you think?
So
do you think
it's about that to me?
Do you think the pass defense is a big question mark though? Because you go back to the two losses they had last season. I would say the biggest thing, the biggest reason they lost was the pass defense.
Michael Penix Jr. I mean, but think about it. It's the strength of your biggest opponent. Washington threw the ball. They had Rome Odunze and Michael Penix Jr. Washington didn't have like an average quarterback who just had a wonderful day against a bad pass defense. Washington was an elite pass attack, and Oregon came up against it just like everybody else came up against it and struggled to defend it. Like, it was Michael Penix Jr. and it was Washington. It was, that was not like, you know, when Oregon got in a game against Oregon State and was faced with DJ Uiagalelei and Oregon State's pass attack, they didn't have any problems. You know, they had no problems whatsoever. It's the strength of your best opponent. Yes, people get caught up going, whoa, wow, they give up a bunch of pass yards in these games. They played an elite quarterback who the Atlanta Falcons went and said, that guy is so good that we already have a quarterback. We're going to take that guy anyway because we see what he can do. And the Chicago Bears, picking a quarterback number one overall, went, you know what? We have another top 10 pick. We're going to use it to take that wide receiver out of Washington. Washington had so many receivers that were dangerous, guys that are obviously going to play at the next level and be stars at the next level. They had a coordinator who had an elite quarterback and an elite group of receivers. That was a great pass attack. Anybody would have struggled against it. But the question this year isn't like, you know, Ohio State has, if anything, they got a little question at quarterback, right? So what is Chip Kelly going to do, guys? Chip Kelly has two great running backs. He might have the best returning running back in the country. He's got a big offensive line. What's Chip Kelly going to do? He's going to run the ball, and then he's going to run it some more, and he's going to try to put Tosh Lapoy and Oregon's run defense in bad situations that they can't manage over and over and over again. He's going to do it. This is what he does. And so it's up to Oregon. It's up to Lapoy. It's up to Oregon's front seven. If they can be a really good run defense, I would love to see teams have to throw against Oregon, because I think those corners, although you look at their defensive backs and you will say, hey, they're young in some spots. Maybe they're going to play young there. I think that is a position group that you can play young in. And Oregon's very talented in that position group. And so I'm not as worried about the pass defense as I am the run scheme. And that's Tosh Lapoy and Dan Lanning and the ability for Oregon to handle the physicality and the talent of Ohio State. It's Ryan Day and Chip Kelly against Tosh Lapoy and Dan Lanning from a schematic standpoint. And it's Ohio State with elite run game personnel. And can Oregon match up against that on October 12th? or do they get put on roller skates and skate it all, you know, out of Lane County or whatever? So that to me is the question. And people will talk about, oh, it was the pass defense last year. Like, let's give Penix some credit. Michael Penix Jr. was so good that Oregon on fourth down went, we can't give you the ball back. You know, like, yeah, we just got to go for it. And what did Penix do when he got the ball? Took him two plays. He just went, think, touchdown. I think he would have done that to a lot of teams.
He did do that to a lot of teams.
And I think, you know, credit to Penix, credit to Ryan Grubb. It was Washington's year last year. Now, granted, if Oregon gets in games this year against Purdue, against Illinois, against Washington even late in the year, and suddenly Oregon is struggling to stop the pass game, I would be really surprised. I just don't think those teams have that kind of personnel. Even Oregon State, especially Oregon State. Like, but if Oregon can play the run tough, they are going to be in that Final Four and possibly in the title game. And who knows what happens if you can get into that title game. But we'll find out on October 12th. That is the question, because, you know, there are very few teams in the country that will be able to run it the way Ohio State's going to run it this year. And, you know, that's going to be really interesting. I'm really curious to see. That is a big question for me. Can Oregon's run defense stay on the field with Ohio State? Second question for Oregon is not about Dylan Gabriel. I left Big Ten Media Day feeling good about Dylan Gabriel. I went there going, I don't know, he can't be Bo Nix. He can't be as good as Bo Nix. Met the kid, spent a little time with him, and walked away going, that guy's going to be all right. Like, he's bigger than I thought he was. You know, at the spring game, he looked small to me. And maybe he's wearing lifts, I don't know. But he looked bigger, more physically imposing to me. And I thought, he's got some moxie. He's got Will Stein. He's got all kinds of weapons. I'm not worried about him. My second question for Oregon is about Dan Lanning. It's why I dedicated part of my interview, my one-on-one with Lanning at Media Day, to rehashing his gunslinging, let's go for it on fourth down mentality against Washington. I really was curious to see if he had given it some thought. I asked Lanning, who are you leaning on for kind of who's coaching the coach, so to speak? And, you know, he talked about being in touch with Kirby Smart, being in touch with other people that had mentored him in the past. I liked that he said that. But Dan Lanning's still 38. He has five losses. We talk a lot about his 22 wins. We talk a lot about all the things he does right. But if you really drill down on the five losses, it's three losses to his rival, Washington. It's a loss against his other rival, Oregon State. And it's a blowout game against Georgia. Throw the Georgia game out. There are some questions that are inherent in lining up against Oregon State twice and going 1-1, and lining up against Washington three times and going 0-3. Those are big rivalry games. I would argue Oregon State did not have Oregon's talent and won that game two seasons ago at Research Stadium and just pile drove Tosh LePoy's defense. I mean, you know, I think the numbers were they handed off 17 straight times to end the game. Mario Cristobal was applauding and salivating from South Beach going, oh, that's exactly how we do it. And I looked back at that and I still think you have to ask questions about Dan Lanning and whether or not he is going to take a step forward as a coach. And so he's got to win the Washington game. He's got to show something in winning at Wisconsin. You know, I was really impressed last year when Oregon went to Utah and embarrassed Utah at Rice-Eccles Stadium. Nobody does that. So that was a really encouraging marker that came late in the year for Oregon. But that Utah team was really banged up. So let's see Dan Lanning win some games that maybe we don't expect him to win. That's Ohio State. Some of us think are going to pick the Ducks. Some of us are not. And that's at Wisconsin. And, you know, a Big Ten championship game. But, you know, and by the way, avoid tripping at Purdue. Avoid losing at home against Illinois. Beat Jonathan Smith in Michigan State. Just, you know, beat them like a pinata when they come to town. So my second question is really about Dan Lanning. Do you have questions about Lanning at all?
I do, yes. And the thing about coaches is when Chip Kelly was the coach of Oregon, the thing they always did was they took care of the opponents they were supposed to. Like, they, you're right. They put them down. They picked them up and then threw them down. And Dan Lanning has done that for the most part, you know, based off of his record. And I think that they'll do that again this year. I think that's really important when they take on some of these Big Ten teams, like you said, at Wisconsin, at a Purdue, when Illinois comes to Autzen. You got to take care of those opponents. And I think that they will. I think, because for me, I do have questions about Dan Lanning just winning the big time game, like just because he hasn't done it. But I don't question like his schemes. I don't question his game plans. I feel like Oregon's had the right game plan going into those games against Washington. They just did not. They just did not win. They did not, you know, make plays when they had to. You go for it on fourth down. That's something you can criticize. I liked the decisions. I think it's very unlikely that they just didn't get one of those first downs or the touchdown when they go for it on fourth down. I put a little bit of blame on the players on that one. I don't put it all on Dan Lanning. But there are questions of, you know, he is only 38 years old. Is he going to make the same decisions again and again and again? Is it a culture thing where we're going to go for it on fourth down in these spots? Or is he going to change it up and punt and kick a field goal? And maybe that comes back to haunt them. So I think there are some in-game things that we still need to see out of Dan Lanning just to get those wins. But I think overall, I don't really question him as a head coach. I do think that there are questions, though, about him to becoming an elite coach. Like, we know his floor is so high of being a great coach, but he's just got to, you know, bust through that and get to the elite level.
He's saying the right things. I need to see him win a game that is a dicey game that we're not sure he can win.
Is that the game at Michigan as well?
Yes. It's Wisconsin, it's Michigan, it's Ohio State. And it's probably the Washington game. But think about, you know, his 27 games that he's coached. I haven't really looked at those bowl games, Liberty, and said, oh, this is a dicey one. Like, you know, I look at Dan Lanning's wins, and I go, you know, he's beat Utah. He beat a pretty good UCLA team two seasons ago at Autzen Stadium. He went in and, you know, beat Oregon State decisively last year at the end of the year, but that Oregon State team looked distracted.
Took care of BYU in that first year at Autzen.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I'm trying to think about, like, he's not often going to be an underdog in a game, right? Even Ohio State coming to Autzen Stadium, by the time that game kicks off, you know, Oregon could be a 2-point favorite, 3-point favorite. I don't know, 1.5 this way, 1.5 that way. But I'm looking for him to win a game maybe that is dicey or that we don't think he can win, because so far he's lost to Georgia. He's lost at Washington. And I think they were the better team that day in the first loss. And then in the second game against Washington, Washington was the better team. And so by the end of the season, Kalen DeBoer had Washington playing better than Dan Lanning had Oregon playing. And because that game at Washington, I felt like Oregon was the better team, and I felt like if Dan Lanning had just played it straight up, like, they probably would have won that game. Now, I supported his decisions to go for it because it was on brand, and he's a little bit of a gunslinger. He's edgy. He's confident. I like that about him. I like that his team knows that he believes in them, so I'm okay with him making a mistake here and there, going for it sometimes when he doesn't get it, because I think over time that will even out. But that first game at Washington, I thought Oregon was the better team. Then they met again late in the year in Vegas on a neutral field, and I thought Washington was the better team. Well, tell me I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. That first game at Washington, I still think, like, feel like they were the better team. And then the Pac-12 game, the championship game, it just got off to such a rough start. Oregon made a nice comeback, but I think Washington was better than that one. So I go back and I look at Lanning's losses. A lot of them are on one score. And they lost both games to Washington that were one score. They lost to Oregon State. That was a one score. They lost to Washington the first year. That was a one score game as well. Four of the five losses have been a one score loss. He only has 3 1 score wins in his 2 years. That's where he needs to show improvement for me, John, is can he make those late game decisions where they win a game at the end against a really tough team? Like going on the road at Texas Tech last season, winning that game by 8, great win because it showed a little bit of, you know, a little bit of character, a little bit of toughness that the Ducks had, but he hasn't really had that many opportunities. Most of his games are blowouts, and so you're right. They're going to be favored in pretty much every single game, but he needs to prove that, you know, like when they beat Utah at Autzen 2017 with Cam Rising and Bo Nix getting hurt, he needs to win more of these close games that they have against these really good teams. He just hasn't done that quite yet. And I don't know if that's on him or if that's on the players or the defensive coordinator, offensive coordinator, whatever it is. But those are the games that he needs to prove that he can win this season.
To be fair to him, he's going to enter a lot of these games as a favorite. So he has very few opportunities to go and say, okay, we're going to be an underdog, and let's see what happens. But I look back, I thought in his first season that the BYU game was an early test, right? As BYU came in there ranked, and Oregon, no doubt about it, wins that game by 3 scores. Then it was several weeks later that UCLA came to town. Same thing. At Autzen Stadium, ranked UCLA team, and Oregon was the better team and decisively won. And Dan Lanning was in such a good mood after that game in October that you remember on the way home, he stopped and he bought those kids gas at the gas station.
That's right.
I could tell after that game that Lanning, there was a little bit of relief or a little bit of joy in him in winning that game, because that game meant more. Beating Chip Kelly in a ranked UCLA team meant more than like winning at Arizona or winning at Washington State or Stanford. You know, it was a good win. Then came Washington. They lose that game at Autzen Stadium, rivalry game. Then they beat Utah. Remember that game? It was a tough game, and it's kind of like a rebound. Then they go to Oregon State, and had he beat Oregon State in that Civil War game, it would have been a really good first season for him. But instead, Kenny Dillingham, blame him if you want, because, you know, he took the job after the game, but Oregon just didn't play as well as they could have, and Oregon State put a foot on their throat and beat him.
Do you think we'd have these questions about Dan Lanning had they won that Oregon State game?
Or one of the Washington games at any point. Even right. Washington in the first year, Washington split the 2 games in the second year. I think there would be fewer questions, but I still am looking at 22-5, Stephen, and I'm going, okay, that's really good, especially for a first-year head coach 2 seasons ago who showed growth in year 2. Now I want to see another step forward in year 3. I'll talk about the Beavers. 2 things I want to see from Oregon State or learn about Oregon State next.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I want you to know that I'm saying this with a smile on my face, but I still don't have my garden hose back. For those of you who know my struggle, if it is one, it's a first world problem, let's face it. But the other day I came home, I had been meeting with a source and drove back to the house, and I came home, and as I pulled into the driveway, I encountered my next-door neighbor who was in a predicament. Nice lady, but she had a problem on her hands. She had a bunch of kids in her front yard. She had a slip and slide, and she had no garden hose. And she says she's on the phone, presumably with her husband, who's probably working. And she's saying to her husband, hold on, John just pulled up. Now, maybe she staged that whole scenario. Maybe there was no one on the other end of the phone. But I took that to mean like she was in a pickle, and I said, what's going on? And she said, well, I did a dumb thing. She said, I invited about 7 kids over, and I have the slip and slide. It's all set up, and we don't have a hose that can attach to the slip and slide. Do you happen to have a hose? And I very quickly, because I'm a problem solver, and, you know, I very quickly went, yeah, hang on. I went through our gate and I grabbed a big hose that happened to be right there, and it was all wound up. It was like, you know, she'd asked for a cup of sugar and I had it on standby. And so I handed her the hose. She's still on the phone with whoever she's talking to, and she's like, basically, oh, he had a hose, never mind. And she thanked me profusely, said, you saved the day, and she disappeared over towards her front lawn with the hose, and I have not seen the hose since. Now, Stephen, at what point do I need to go and be like, hey, do you have the hose, or do I just kind of let it go for a while and see what happens? So what, I didn't give it to her.
No. So what day was it? What day did officially you give it over? Gave over the hose?
I'm gonna say. So it was. I think it was Tuesday.
I would say by the weekend, like on Saturday. If you don't get it back by Saturday, I think it would be okay to knock on the door and be like, "Hey, you're still using the hose? I might need it this weekend."
Or do I just take it back?
No, I feel like you should ask.
Do I go and ask if I can borrow my hose?
Just tell one of the one of the daughters to go sneak in the backyard. And
I'm in a pickle here. I am trying to put water in the dog's dishes, and I realized I don't have my hose. So
I don't think you need a reason why you want the hose back. I think it's okay to just be like, "Can I get my hose back?"
I have a thing about borrowing things. I don't borrow. I mean, and Anna thinks I'm weird for it. I don't like the feeling of owing someone, and I don't like the pressure of taking like something that belongs to someone else and then having the pressure of bringing it back in the same condition. You know, like my big thing is like, you know, if I ever borrowed something from someone and like it broke, and then having that pressure of going, "Oh my gosh, I feel so bad. I need to replace it." I would rather go down to like the hardware store or run to the grocery store to get what I need. Do you need eggs? Do you need milk? I would rather do that than knock on somebody's door and be like, "Hey, can I borrow a cup of sugar?" But my mother-in-law grew up more communal that way. And when she's visiting us, she will frequently knock on the neighbor's door and ask to borrow something. And I have always felt like, you know, don't do that. I'll just go to the store. I can get it. You don't need to do that. But I think there's a mentality there that it's almost like it's an excuse to have a social interaction rather than the actual functionality of needing to borrow something. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, like is she borrowing like a cup of sugar or like
that kind of stuff
or like utensil?
She borrowed a garden
hose
tool, like a hoe from the neighbor, and I was like, "I have one of those. Why are we borrowing this?" But I think it was more. I think that for some people get comfort from living around people they know and they interact with, and knowing that your neighbor has your back in some small way probably feels good. And maybe the neighbor is borrowing the hose from me just to say, "Hey, John's got my back. I know if I'm ever in a pickle and it comes to like, you know, we're being invaded by China or Russia. And, you know, I say to him, 'Hey, man, we need rations.' He's got me, you know, like he loaned me the hose. He's got my back." But I think other people like me don't really want to be in that relationship with anybody. I'm happy to loan you the hose, but I do kind of expect that I'm going to get it back. And now, you know, I know what's going to happen. Anna's going to be like, "Why are you talking about this on air?" They're going to hear about it. Somebody's going to tell them about it. I don't think they're bad people. I just am kind of wondering at what point, like, when does it get awkward? It's a Larry David thing. At what point, Steve, and you say Saturday is the day?
Yeah, I think by the weekend's okay. Like, you had the whole week. You had the week to do it.
I would give that thing back same day.
I would,
like,
too.
As soon as we're done using it for the slip and slide, my next movement would be to nicely fold that thing up, make sure there's no damage to it, and then put it back where it came from.
Like, because, do we know? Did she use it again? Did they have another slip and slide party throughout the week?
For all I know, it's out there. For all I know, it got loaned to someone else. I don't know.
That's the fear, right? Like, oh man, now someone else brought this thing.
It's not even the hose. It's the fact that there's some bandwidth in my brain that's being taken up by this.
Well, you don't want to be taken. You don't like to be taken, like, you know, taken over, right? Like, you don't want to be.
Who does?
Yeah, like you especially. I feel like you don't want to get you know, people getting over on you.
I don't want to be taken advantage of.
Yeah,
but I also don't mind being neighborly to it. Like, I did not hesitate to give her the hose. I just thought the next day I kind of looked around. I expected, you know, maybe it would be in the driveway or something, and I was like, "Huh, no hose." And then every day now, when I come home, I'm looking around.
I feel like Saturday you could ask for it back. Be like, "Hey, you know what? Are you done with this?"
I'm not even going to do that. I'm not going to ask for it back. If they never give it back, they never get anything ever again. They ask me for you know, let's
so
say
so now you're testing them.
Let's say there's no. Let's say the water pipes are broken. Let's say China hacks the grid and there's no power, and there's no water, and they're going, "Can we get a cup of water?" I'm gonna be like, "Where's my hose?"
I'll trace you. No, the water right. for hose.
Damn right, not happening. Brings me to Oregon State. Two questions for Oregon State. I covered Oregon, but I have two questions for Oregon State. One. Who's playing quarterback and how good can they be at that position? That's two questions, really, but I'm mainly concerned about the quarterback play at Oregon State. Ben Gulbranson, I trust him. He's got some leadership skills. I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, but that guy's going to have to make some plays, and he's going to be in some games that are, you know, he's not going to have Damian Martinez behind him. He's not going to have quite the receiving core that Jonathan Smith had a year ago. So how will that Ryan Gunderson quarterback position go? And, you know, Gunderson, I think, is a really good coach. And I think Gunderson is going to end up being fine when he gets guys. But how can he MacGyver this season with his quarterback? That, you know, which MacGyver is playing quarterback, I guess, is the real question. So I have questions about Oregon State's quarterback. And then secondarily, my question for Oregon State is kind of on the defensive side of the ball. You know, Trent Bray, I thought, did a really nice job when Tim Tibisar was demoted and Trent Bray became the defensive coordinator at Oregon State. There was a shift in attitude and mentality that happened with the defense. And I really came to appreciate and enjoy Trent Bray's defenses. And they were often marked by players like, you know, Jack Coletto and Jaden Grant, veteran players who played above their heads. They were not the best athletes, you know, by combine standards, but these were smart guys who played really motivated and inspired defense. And Oregon State playing at home at Reser Stadium became a really tough out in the last 2 years because of Trent Bray's defenses. Now that he has moved to become a head coach, he's got Keith Hayward on that side of the ball. I've asked Oregon State for an interview with Keith Hayward. He's coming on the show. He's in the queue, so to speak. So can the defense that isn't led by Trent Bray still play like a Trent Bray defense? That's the question. It's an overarching umbrella question about that defense. Will they continue to make more with less and be play inspired and be a highlight part of that team, or will they take a step back? It's that simple. Quarterback play and then the defense in general. And it's not really a run game, pass game thing. It's more of a, you know, what kind of energy do they bring? Because when Trent Bray took over, it was the same guys that Tibisar had. But all of a sudden, they were different. They were better. And that defense was fun to watch. All right, we're back with another great show tomorrow. I appreciate everybody who listens to this show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. And read me at johnconzano.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.